Celeste Quinn. Coming up, a new special from NPR. We will broadcast the Capitol Steps Halloween special at 3:30 this afternoon. It will be repeated at 6:30 this evening, and we will air the first half of The World at 3 and the entire hour at 7 this evening. Cap Steps this afternoon at 3:30 and 6:30 this evening.
From NPR News in Washington, this is Special Coverage. I'm Neil Conan. This morning, President Bush nominated Samuel Alito to the United States Supreme Court. Judge Alito is very different from Mr. Bush's previous choice to replace Sandra Day O'Connor. Last Thursday, Harriet Myers was forced to withdraw under withering criticism, especially from the right wing of the Republican Party. In Myers, the president named a woman with no judicial experience. By contrast, Samuel Alito has served 15 years on the 3rd U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Philadelphia. Before he was appointed to the federal bench by the first President Bush, Alito worked in the Justice Department, argued cases before the Supreme Court as Deputy Solicitor General, and served as the U.S. Attorney, the Chief Federal Prosecutor in New Jersey. Again, unlike Harriet Myers, Judge Alito has a long track record on constitutional issues. So far, at least, most conservatives are pleased, while liberal response ranges from caution to outright opposition. Joining us now to discuss the nomination and what it means for the court and for politics are David Savage, who covers Supreme Court for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks for coming in, David.
Hi, Neil.
Also with us here in Studio 3A is NPR's political correspondent, Mara Liasson. Mara, good to talk to you again.
Good to be here.
David, let's start with you. What do we know about Judge Alito?
Well, the first thing Judge Alito has to get over is his nickname. He's known as Scalito. Some people have used his name to say he's a lot like Antonin Scalia in background and style. He's a conservative, has an Italian-American heritage. I actually think he will be able to get beyond that, because if you read his opinions or follow sort of what he said, he's a much more judicious person than Scalia. He's not a wise guy. He doesn't have a lot of sort of derisive comments about arguments he disagrees with. I spent a lot of time reading opinions of his yesterday, and he strikes me as a very very good judge, a very judicious person.
If President Bush was looking for somebody who could unite conservatives and then maybe split away a few Democrats as well, maybe Samuel Alito is his man?
Certainly on the first, not clear on the second. That is, certainly he will unite conservatives. They're all back in the fold and ready to support him. Very happy with his nomination. He'd been on their short list for a long time. I think it's unclear about Democrats and liberals. There's a lot of opposition right away. They seem ready to fight on the other side. And we're really just beginning in this process. This guy has a lot of opinions, 300-some opinions. We'll learn a lot about him over the next couple of weeks, and we'll see just how strong the, what kind of fight the Democrats can put on.
And I guess that's the question to you, Mara Liasson. Political reaction, pleasure on the right. Caution, if not outright pain on the left.
Yeah, there's no doubt about this. I mean, I feel like the Democrats have woken up from this very pleasant daydream where they watched the Republicans form a circular firing squad, and now they're back to where they were before, where they have somebody much like Roberts in terms of his credentials and his abilities.
John Roberts, who was just confirmed
his legal qualifications, only more so because he's been on the bench for a long time. I think that the Democrats, that he will guaranteed as a baseline get more no votes than Roberts did. But the question is, as you said, can Democrats either peel away some moderate Republicans to vote no, or get enough of those moderate to conservative Democrats who are part of the Gang of 14 who were promised to vote not to filibuster, get them to change their minds and declare an extraordinary circumstance in the case of Sam Alito and vote for a filibuster? I think that's going to be tough. One thing that's different with this nominee, different than Roberts, certainly different than Myers, is he's not a man of mystery. We're not going to have to look to speeches he gave, I don't think. I mean, maybe David differs, but I don't think we're going to have to plumb writings or speeches or any kind of obscure statements of his. He's got 15 years of decisions, and some of them are on the hot button issues, and I think people will not have to talk about what kind of person he is or what kind of church he goes to or anything like that. They're going to know how conservative he is.
And that raises the question of, is that track record a little too long? As you said, David Savage, it's going to be quite some time before people get a chance to go back through the whole record. But, well, we remember the case of Robert Bork, whose record on a lot of controversial issues was, it turned out, too controversial.
Well, Bork was the kind of guy who said things and gave speeches and wrote articles and wrote op-ed pieces and took really strong opinions. I disagree with Maura in part, is that this guy has a very long record of decisions, but he writes decisions as a lower court judge, and they are sort of attempts to discern what the Supreme Court meant on some hard issue. And he sort of he writes his opinions as a judge trying to apply the law, and you don't get from many of them what Sam Alito thinks. There's not a lot of sort of strong opinions of his in his opinions. They are sort of a judge's attempt to apply the law as he understands it.
Well, give us a for instance, particularly in the case of where he was part of the court ruling on a decision about spousal permission for abortion.
Yes, this is the one that will be talked about a lot, Neil. It's Planned Parenthood versus Casey. The situation is that in 1989, the Supreme Court was closely split on abortion. Justice O'Connor had the deciding middle vote, and she said states can regulate abortion so long as they do not put an undue burden on the woman's right to get an abortion. And she said an undue burden is something like an absolute obstacle or a barrier. Pennsylvania then passed some very stringent abortion regulations.
Casey, then the governor of Pennsylvania.
Yes. And then the question when it came to the Third Circuit, where Sam Alito said, are these regulations constitutional? And one of them was that in almost all instances, the woman had to say she notified her spouse, unless there was some fear of violence or abuse or something like that. The two judges in the majority struck that down and said that goes too far. That puts an undue burden. That's really going to block some women from having abortions. Sam Alito wrote a dissent and said, from what I can tell, Justice O'Connor's view is that it's okay to regulate abortion as long as there's not a barrier. He cited a series of opinions where she had upheld parental notification requirements as not posing an undue burden. So he thought this wasn't an undue burden. Now, I think a lot of women, including Justice O'Connor, are sort of insulted by the notion of a state law that says a wife is sort of compelled to notify her husband.
And smacks of getting the husband's permission.
Yes, that's right. And in the end, Justice O'Connor and the Supreme Court struck down that provision. So Alito's opinion is, I think, will be controversial for that reason.
But I think then-Chief Justice William Rehnquist cited Justice Alito's opinion in his dissent from the Supreme Court decision, and he's going to be portrayed. The reason this is coming up so intently, Maura, is that Sandra Day O'Connor, as Dave was saying, she was the swing vote, not just on abortion, but on other issues as well. And these decisions are absolutely vital to the political base of both political
parties.
That's
right. And you know, it's interesting. Okay, David certainly corrected me, and I stand corrected in that because he's an appellate judge, he wasn't writing his own opinion. He's applying Supreme Court law. What's interesting here is up until now, you've had two candidates in varying degrees were stealth candidates. Roberts was a bit of a stealth candidate. Myers was the, you know, this class A stealth candidate. But you now have conservatives openly, and I think on our air this morning, you had Jay Sekulow saying he will move the court to the right. I mean, this is conservatives are absolutely upfront about this. This is what they wanted. They didn't want to pussyfoot around, make apologies for being in the Federalist Society. You know, what's embarrassing about being a conservative, all these people said. Now they've got somebody who is clear in the mold of Scalia. His nickname is Scalito. And I think that that makes this debate crystal clear. This is a person who isn't being sold as somebody in the mode of Sandra Day O'Connor, despite all the nice words he might have had to say about her.
Mm-hmm.
This is somebody who will move the balance of power on the court to the right. And that, I think, is going to make it easier for Democrats to mount an opposition. I don't know if they can succeed. Easier to mount an opposition, a little bit harder for the president to sell Alito to the public at large as someone who's you know, who could go either way on some of these decisions. And I think that because of the Myers debacle, it makes it even harder than if Alito had been his first choice.
Yet the president, as conservatives will say, ran for re-election, promising appoint justices along the lines of Scalia and Thomas.
And the difference is when he was running and saying those kinds of things or saying the various euphemisms that you use for when you talk about judges, he would say them in certain places to certain audiences, and those claims weren't in his campaign commercials or in his speech at the convention, I don't think. I might be wrong. But the point is, those concerns, those kinds, that claim to say that he's going to promote people like Scalia and Thomas, those only meant something to the activists that care about the Supreme Court until now, when it really matters. You know, this is the kind of court fight that the public could pay attention to and care about.
When John Roberts' name came up for nomination before the Senate Judiciary Committee and then the full Senate, the Democrats split 22-22, 22 in favor, 22 yeah. against.
That won't happen again.
A lot of people thought liberal interest groups gave Democratic senators a free ride saying, look, Roberts for Rehnquist, it's a wash. We'll care about your vote next time.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that they're expecting a lot more Democratic opposition. How unified the Democrats can be is a big question. Will they mount a filibuster, and will it come to the showdown over the filibuster that we walked up to the brink of and then stepped back from just a couple months ago, I guess?
Well, I guess it was last spring, but
last
it seems
spring,
like a long time ago when the Gang of 14 was formed, seven Democrats, seven Republicans who said, unless there are extraordinary circumstances, we agree that there will be no filibusters. They control enough votes to make sure one way or the other. And it remains to be seen whether that coalition will survive this particular test. And the other thing that people are going to be looking at, David Savage, as you mentioned, there's a long record to go back and look at. The president says he wants confirmation hearings by the end of the year. Senate Judiciary Committee says, come on, January.
Yeah, this seems to me there's a good argument for taking their time and looking through a lot of his opinions, because this fight, I think, will turn on sort of his opinions. You know, the easy way, if you're a Democrat, to defeat a Republican nominee would be to say, A, the nominee is not qualified, doesn't have the qualifications to be on the Supreme Court. Harriet Meyer sort of fit that category. B, there's the sort of Robert Bork or Clarence Thomas or to some Janice Rogers Brown, a person who has made a series of inflammatory speeches or statements that will sort of set people off. Janice Rogers Brown talks about 1937 as the year that socialism has arrived in America. This guy, I don't think, is either one of those. So if he's going to be defeated, it's going to have to be on a series of opinions that Democrats can say, these, you put them all together, and they're too far right.
But basically, on the timing of the hearings, Democrats will want as long as possible to do as much research as possible.
Yes.
Republicans will want it as quickly as possible.
Yes. Bill Frist, when they first came up this morning, said, we need to move fast on this.
Thank you very much, David Savage, who covers the Supreme Court for the Los Angeles Times, and Mara Liasson, NPR's political correspondent. They were both with us here in Studio 3A. When we come back from a short break, more about Samuel Alito's career as a lawyer and as a judge. I'm Neil Conan. Back after the break, this is special coverage from NPR News.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Lincoln Square Village in Urbana, with more than a dozen shops, businesses, and restaurants, including Art Mart and Art Mart Toys, on the web at artmart-food-toys.com, and Boyer Drawing and Painting, producer of murals, scenic art, and faux finishing classes. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from Horene's Pianos Plus, your Steinway Piano Showroom in Bloomington. Horene's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos.
This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. When President Bush nominated Judge Samuel Alito for a seat on the Supreme Court earlier today, he emphasized Alito's judicial experience, an obvious contrast with former nominee Harriet Myers. Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist, appearing at a news conference with Judge Alito, said it had long been in the cards. Frist pointed to a Princeton yearbook, which said Alito intended one day... The Princeton yearbook said Alito intended one day to warm a seat on the high court. For his part, Judge Alito said he hadn't been serious about the Supreme Court when he filled out that yearbook form.
Well, that was a college joke. I think my real ambition at the time was to be the commissioner of baseball, and I probably should have put that down. And of course, I never dreamed that this day would actually arrive.
Judge Alito's roots run deep in the state of New Jersey, which baseball fans will note has no major league team of its own. He was born in the capital, Trenton, and before serving on the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, he was U.S. attorney for the state of New Jersey. Kate Coscarelli is a legal reporter for the Newark Star-Ledger. She profiled Alito for the Ledger in May. She joins us now by phone from her office in Newark, New Jersey. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
When you spoke with Judge Alito in May, what was he like just as an interview?
Just as an interview, he's a nice guy. You know, I mean, he has quite a reputation for being very quiet, monastic is sort of the term that most of the people who've worked with him use right after they use the word brilliant about him. But when you're sitting there, he's got this great old chambers with, you know, all the wood paneling, and he didn't sit behind his desk. He sat there in an armchair right next to me. You know, he was very, very affable, you know, made some, you know, funny remarks and, you know, very, very casual, certainly didn't wear his robes, nothing pretentious like that about him.
Did you discuss judicial philosophy with him?
We did. We did discuss it a bit. You know, I said, I were talking to him and I said, you know, you have these reputation, you know, sort of a conservative reputation, nicknames, Scalito, Little Nino, and some of those. And I said, you have this real, you know, reputation as a conservative judge. And he bristled, you know, quite honestly, you know, when I said that, and he said his approach to decisions is simply to decide what the law calls for and go no further. He said most of the labels people use to talk about judges and the way judges decide cases aren't too descriptive. Judges should be judges. They shouldn't be legislators. They shouldn't be administrators. You know, he was very, very, very set on that, you know, that was his role.
But he didn't describe himself into any of the various schools of thought about interpretation of the Constitution, so far as you could tell, anyway?
No, he certainly did not. You know, in the discussion that we had, he shied away from the term conservative. I don't think there's anybody floating around out there who would use the term liberal to describe him. He certainly did not want to park himself in any one spot.
I know you spoke with judges and attorneys in New Jersey that have worked with him or argued before him. What do they say?
Absolutely. You know, I've talked to people who worked with him in the U.S. Attorney's Office, people who have sat on panels with him in the Third Circuit, and people who have argued cases before him. And, you know, everybody says, you know, he has this amazing memory. You know, attorneys who would go into, when he was a U.S. attorney, to talk about a complicated case, you know, they would go in and they would study up on the particular issue, and they said by the time they hit Judge Alito's office, he already knew everything, and it wasn't because he had been prepping the way they had. It was just because he knew it. And colleagues on the Third Circuit say that, you know, he's the kind of guy who will sit there very patiently, listen to whatever, you know, anything the lawyers want to say. He's very reserved during oral arguments, they say. But when he does open his mouth, you really have to listen, because the questions, the kinds of things he's asking, the direction of his questions really go cut right to the center of the controversial point of the subject, and they really cut to that center of what's being decided at the moment.
On the Supreme Court, Judge Antonin Scalia, the source of that Scalito nickname and the Little Nino nickname as well, is known for being brusque, even caustic with his questions. Is Judge Alito the same way?
Not at all. Not at all. In fact, it's a very, very different reputation. You know, everything from the sidelines of his son's soccer games to the courtroom, you know, to even private dealings with lawyers. He is polite. He is, you know, gentlemanly is the kind of thing you hear people. He's, you know, I talk to people who say they have worked with him for years and have never once heard him, not only never heard him raise his voice, but never curse. You know, I mean, never pound his fist in frustration in the way that you know, some other people do. They say he's not that kind of guy.
The Third Circuit has a reputation as one of the more liberal circuits around the United States. What is this conservative justice's reputation among his colleagues?
Among his colleagues, you know, I spoke with Marianne Trump-Berry, Judge Garth, Judge Cowan, a number of the judges there, and they all, you know, he clerked for Judge Garth when he was, Judge Alito did, he clerked for Judge Garth once he was out of law school, and Judge Garth likes to joke that he's such a quiet guy that, you know, the first day he showed up in chambers, he said hello, and the last day he said goodnight, and that he pretty much didn't hear anything from him in the meantime. But everybody says he's a very, very nice guy, you know, very, writes, you know, he writes almost all of his own opinions, as opposed to the habit some people do, which is using law clerks to do it. He told me he really enjoys the writing. He really enjoys the research. He compared it to putting together a puzzle.
Kate Coscarelli, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Kate Coscarelli, a legal reporter for the Newark Star-Ledger. She joined us by phone from her office in Newark, New Jersey. Samuel Alito served on the Third Circuit for 15 years. Timothy Lewis was a judge on that same circuit court in 7 of those years. He joins us now by phone from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And Judge Lewis, very good of you to join us today.
Thank you very much. Happy to be with you.
I wonder, how would you describe Sam Alito?
Well, Sam Alito is a first and foremost a true intellectual. He is, in my view, a very thoughtful, very balanced, and very fair judge. I happen to think that he's actually an excellent judge. It was a pleasure for me to have served with him on the Third Circuit for those years. I guess at bottom, and this is the most important quality to me for anyone who puts on the robes, Sam Alito is intellectually honest. I do not recall an instance during the years that we served together, and even though I came from a very different ideological perspective than Sam, I do not recall an instance where I felt that Sam was result-oriented in any way or seem to have any particular agenda. He just is a conservative. He is a conservative by nature, by personality, and certainly by jurisprudence. But he was a pleasure to work with, and frankly, I'm delighted for him today, and I think that he will make a fine justice on the Supreme Court, although I do say that there may be many instances in which Sam and I will not agree.
There are some who read his opinion in the Planned Parenthood versus Casey opinion and say they can feel a visceral dislike for abortion there.
You know, that is a bit of a reach, I think. I was not on the court when that matter was decided. Had I been on the court then, I can assure you I would not have voted as Sam did. However, I don't know that that one can extrapolate from his views in that case predict that he will, as some have said, overrule Roe versus Wade or whatever. You know, what I think is that a lot of the folks on the far right whose views I've heard since the nomination was made this morning are way overstating their case, and I think that the same is true on the left, the far left, in terms of the fears of, you know, what Sam might do on the court and so forth. He's just a very careful, very cautious judge who approaches matters from a somewhat conservative perspective, but I don't think that there are any predictors there one way or the other as far as Roe versus Wade is concerned.
One phrase we're going to be hearing a lot when his confirmation hearings begin, same phrase I guess we heard a lot in the John Roberts confirmation hearings, stare decisis. Does he feel bound, do you think, by the previous decisions of the Supreme Court, decisions that have been affirmed again and again over time, which seem to be part of the bedrock of American law? And I guess we're going back to that same Roe versus Wade.
I have little doubt, based on the years that I spent sitting next to Judge Alito on the bench during oral argument and sitting next to him in chambers after oral argument, where we would decide, confer and decide the cases, I have absolutely no doubt that Sam understands and has a very high respect for stare decisis. Let me just tell you a little anecdote that might shed some light on Sam as a judge and why he is so well respected even by those who don't agree with him and don't share some of his views. The night before I was sworn in on the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, the late and legendary Judge Leon Higginbotham had me in his chambers. Now, Leon Higginbotham, some of you may not remember, may not know, was a wonderful African-American judge. I am also an African-American, and who was also a great writer and historian, certainly did not come from what anyone could call a conservative judicial perspective. But Judge Higginbotham had me in his chambers, and we went down the roster of my colleagues to be when I would be sworn in the very next day, and he was discussing each one. And we got to Judge Alito. He said, "Now, Sam Alito is my kind of conservative." I said, "What do you mean by that, Judge?" And he said, "He does not have an agenda. He does not approach things in any predisposed fashion. He's got a very open mind. He just is a conservative, but he's honest. And I love sitting with him, and I love working with him." And I learned what Judge Higginbotham meant during the years that I was privileged to sit on that court and serve with Sam. He simply is an excellent and brilliant jurist who, as I said over and over, just comes at things from a different perspective from mine. But he earned my respect during those years. And as I said, I think he'll be just fine on the court.
Does he have the demeanor to be a judge, do you think?
There's just no question about that. If anything, he is about as shy and reticent a person as I know. And frankly, I was stunned by his delivery this morning at the White House in accepting the nomination, because he is so shy personally, and his demeanor is pretty much reflected, I think, by your earlier commentator who was talked about his experience as a law clerk for Judge Garth. He is a person of very few words, but when he speaks, you can't help but listen very carefully. I mean, he is not an in-your-face, gavel-beating, pounding person by any stretch of the imagination.
As you obviously followed civil rights cases very closely, the circuit that they came up more than occasionally in the Third Circuit. Do you have any concerns about his positions on civil rights?
I would have concerns about any nominee that this president makes on the matter of civil rights. I have deep concerns about this administration's approach to and views on civil rights. Of course, that said. I am practical enough to understand that this president is going to appoint a conservative. I think that in appointing Sam Alito, he is, based on my experience with him, with Judge Alito, appointed someone who has an open mind and I do not believe is going to try to do harm to well-established civil rights that have helped make this country great. And frankly, I think you mentioned earlier bedrock decisions and stare decisis are now a part of the court's of the institution of the Supreme Court, and I do believe that he will respect that. I think that as I said, I don't expect anything but a conservative justice, but in Sam Alito we have a very fine judge, someone who I think will grow into the position as he sits on the court in the years to come. And I have high hopes that he will continue to show the respect for the law, the established law that he has thus far.
We're speaking with Judge Timothy Lewis, who served on the Third Circuit Court of Appeals with Sam Alito for 7 years. You're listening to special coverage from NPR News. And Judge Lewis, if I could ask you, you got to watch him Judge Alito, both under the pressure of live court arguments and also in a more thoughtful vein when he was writing and participating in decisions. He's got a test very few of us would relish coming ahead. That's his appearance before the Senate Judiciary Committee. How do you think he'll do?
Oh, I think he'll do well. I mean, as I said, he's a man of few words. He's very soft-spoken, even reticent, I would say. But he's also he's a true intellectual and legal scholar. He is well-versed in the Constitution and in the important precedents of the Supreme Court that I think the committee will want to talk to him about. And on the whole, I think that he will do well. This is a person who I think one of the things that I respect the most about Sam is that he is not a kind of a politico, if you will. And I expect that, like you saw with Judge Roberts and now Justice Roberts, you will see someone who is simply trying to do the best that he can to answer questions from a legal scholarly point of view, as opposed to just providing satisfactory answers that might assuage one side or the other. I truly believe that. So I think he'll do well, but it's going to be very difficult, as it would with anyone.
Judge Lewis, thanks very much for being with us today. Thank you for your time.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, sir.
Timothy Lewis, now an attorney with Schrader, Harrison, Siegel & Lewis, a law firm based in Philadelphia. He's a former judge on the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, where he served with Samuel Alito, and he spoke with us from his office in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. As we mentioned, President Bush's previous nominee for this position, Harriet Myers, drew unwavering criticism from many on the right wing of the Republican Party. Joining us now is David Frum, a former Bush speechwriter and author of The Right Man, The Surprise Presidency of George W. Bush. He was among those critics of Harriet Myers. David Frum, nice of you to be with us today.
Thank you very much.
We just have a couple of minutes before we have to go to a break, but I did want to ask you, are you happier with the nomination of Samuel Alito?
I'm dancing on the rooftops. I think this is a fantastic choice. I think conservatives of all description and really everyone who cares about the law is going to be delighted with this nomination.
What in particular about Judge Alito's past gives you that confidence?
Well, I think he's good both for conservatives and for the country. First, he's brilliant, which is something that I think Americans are entitled to expect from those people who take on this extraordinarily heavy responsibility at the Supreme Court. I think he's somebody who has a conservative and constitutional philosophy, but is a very fair-minded person. He has independence from the White House. When he reaches judgments, and we hope they will be broadly supportive of the authority the president needs to win the war on terror, they will be credible because they're coming from someone who's outside, who wasn't party to making those decisions in the first place. I think he will, Americans, when they see him on television at these hearings, will say, this is a fair-minded person. This is a person who will do justice in the way that I want to see it done. So just all around, a great success.
More with David Frum in just a moment. We'll also be joined by David Korn, Washington editor for The Nation magazine, with another perspective on today's nomination by President Bush of Judge Samuel Alito, currently serves on the Third Circuit Court of Appeals in Philadelphia, to fill the Supreme Court seat to be vacated by Sandra Day O'Connor. More after the break. I'm Neil Conan. This is Special Coverage from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from National Geographic magazine. This month, reporting on longevity and the lifestyle ingredients for adding 10 years to your life, on newsstands and at ngm.com. From Entrepreneur magazine, presenting its annual Young Millionaires issue, featuring millionaires under 40. The November issue is on newsstands now. And from sitforless.com, direct seller of the Herman Miller Aeron Chair, all Aeron colors and configurations available on the web at sitforless.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the U of I Office of the Chancellor, supporting the Campus Charitable Fund Drive. Each year, contributions from U of I employees on the Urbana-Champaign campus help support 11 social service agencies and other nonprofit organizations. Information on how to give and how your donations will help our community is on the web at www.ccfd.uiuc.edu.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by the U of I's Center for Advanced Study, whose MillerCom 2006 lecture series presents The Slow-Motion Suicide of the American Empire by columnist and cartoonist Ted Rall on Thursday, November 3rd at 4 p.m. at the Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus. For more information, go to www.cas.uiuc.edu.
This is Special Coverage from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. At about 8 o'clock this morning Eastern Time, President Bush nominated Judge Samuel Alito, who serves on the Third Circuit Court of Appeals in Philadelphia, to serve on the Supreme Court of the United States. He would replace Sandra Day O'Connor, who has submitted her resignation. President Bush's previous nominee for that post, Harriet Myers, withdrew her name from consideration last week after she took political fire from right and left. Mostly right. We're talking today with David Frum, who's the former speechwriter for President Bush and author of The Right Man, The Surprise Presidency of George W. Bush. And also joining us here in Studio 3A is David Korn, Washington editor for The Nation magazine. I'm going to ask both of them to stay with us just for a moment, because joining us now on the line from Capitol Hill is Senator Mark Pryor, a Democrat from Arkansas. He was a member of the so-called Gang of 14, senators who negotiated an agreement over use and non-use of the filibuster. He's with us from his office here in Washington. Senator Pryor, nice of you to be with us today.
Hey, Neil. Thank you for having me on.
What's your initial reaction to the name of Samuel Alito?
Well, like most of America, before this morning, I didn't know very much about him. Learned quite a bit today through the media. He sounds like someone who has a lot of credentials there. And basically, when I look at these Supreme Court nominations, or really any of the judicial nominations, I have a three-part criteria. One is credentials. Second is his judicial temperament. And third is, will the nominee be fair and impartial when on the bench? And that third criteria is where you get into the question of activism and, you know, sort of some of the agenda that they might bring to the court.
Mm-hmm. The Gang of 14's agreement was that nominations would be voted up or down except in extraordinary circumstances. Thus far, do you see anything that would qualify the Alito nomination for extraordinary circumstances?
By the way, let me say this. The people in Arkansas never thought I'd come to Washington and join a gang. Okay, but I have, I guess. And you're right. We did use the phrase extraordinary circumstances, and it's just too early to know whether there are any extraordinary circumstances around this nomination. Quite frankly, I start with the presumption that there are none. And unless I'm convinced that they develop, you know, in my mind, there are none. But it is so early, given the fact that it's less than 24 hours old at this point. It's possible those will develop, and I hope they don't. I don't really anticipate that they will, but it is possible. And I think we're going to have the 14 of us and the Gang of 14 sit down at some point this week. I don't know if that's been scheduled yet, but everybody's traveling today, but probably sit down this week and start the process of talking about this nomination.
One of the issues that's already come up, the president said he would like the Senate to vote on this before the end of the year, and there have been some members of the Judiciary Committee who have been saying, well, wait a minute, we want to make sure we take our time with this nomination and go back through the record, and realistically, January is about the time that hearings could get underway.
Well, this is a lifetime appointment, and there's no doubt, you can just look at Senator Day O'Connor's record, that these justices will have a tremendous influence on American law and on American society. My hope is that this process in the U.S. Senate, the confirmation process, will be very rigorous, but also very fair. And I don't know exactly how long it takes, but when you look at how many legislative days we have left this year, you know, we only have about 60 days left in the year. We don't have that many legislative days, considering the fact that we have two or three fairly major holidays during this next 60 days. So I don't know how realistic it is that we can actually have a vote on this before the first of the year. We'll just have to see what Senator Leahy and Senator Specter are able to work out there.
I was going to describe you as a member of the Caucus of 14. I'm not sure people in Arkansas would be any happier with that.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Senator Pryor, thanks very much for being with us.
Hey, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Democrat Mark Pryor of Arkansas joined us from his office in Washington, D.C. And, well, let's get back to our commentators, David Korn, Washington editor of The Nation magazine, and David Frum, who writes a blog for National Review Online. And, well, David Korn, we have yet to hear from you on the new nomination. Is this different? Is this something where Democrats, you think, are going to be ready to make a fight?
Well, first, let me congratulate David Frum. It's very rare that we see a president actually bow down and kiss the feet of his critics. And, I mean, this is exactly what they wanted, why they wanted to get Harriet Myers out of the way, to get somebody in who was someone I would call a right-wing legal warrior. I don't mean that in a pejorative sense, but somebody who people on the right have long wanted to put on the court because their intellectual force and abilities would help steer the court to the right. And David and Bill Kristol and the others are very overt in their agenda. I mean, there's nothing secretive about this. And I think because of that, there are people on the left, and we see some early Democratic senators coming out and saying, wait a second, we're losing a Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, who was in the middle. And there is a move here to move the court to the right. The president did win the election, but with 58.8% of the vote, at a time when the court is deciding all sorts of very crucial issues, from assisted suicide to presidential elections, whether environmental laws apply or don't apply. And, of course, abortion and privacy right matters. Maybe we're beyond the day where it's just a matter of qualifications. If people like David and Bill Kristol and others want to push the court to the right, it's not just a matter of qualifications. There's an agenda here. Well, then the other side has the right to say, wait a second, we're going to fight against that. And why? Because we don't believe it's in the interest of the United States to move the court to the right and to have the decisions come down that way. So what I'm looking at here, or what we might be looking at, I don't know, you know, Mark Pryor didn't give us too many clues there, would be a big, you know, fight, as perhaps there should be, about these key policy issues, because, they, as I said, the court is playing this crucial role, and it's become sort of the fulcrum point for a lot of issues in our society. And so I assume that a lot of liberal lobbying groups and such are expecting the Democrats to put up a big fight, but they can only really do that if they get 40 or more Democrats, 41 or more Democrats, who all agree. So the gang of the Democratic half of the caucus or gang of 14 are going to have to come along and join the rest of the Democrats to do that. And right now, I can't make a prediction whether that's going to occur.
David Frum, some say that this is a fight that some on the right, at least, have been hoping for.
Well, I don't think anybody on the right is looking for a fight. They're looking for a great justice. And I also have to say with I'd like to take David's compliment. I don't think the president kissed anybody's anything. I think he corrected a mistake. But I think one of the things that I hope people on the other side of the aisle and the other side of the ideological spectrum will take away from watching this battle over Harriet Myers is, you know, the court is not just about policy. It's not just about winning. I think conservatives set a real example here of principle. One of the things I wrote was, even if I were assured that Harriet Myers would vote the way I want her to in every single case, I would still be against this nomination. And so many conservatives said the same thing because they believe in the institutions of the country. They believe in something bigger than getting their way. And I hope Democrats will take a look at that and say, you know, that the court is about these enduring things. Samuel Alito is the kind of person who belongs on the Supreme Court when there's a Republican president. And I think the exact parallel is what happened with Stephen Breyer. Republicans would have wished they won the election in 1992. They didn't. They would have wished they had the Senate in 1992. They didn't. So there was a Democratic president, and they went out and they got the best liberal they could find. And I think he's been an ornament to the country. And I think that's the way it's going to work on this other side. I don't believe we're going to see a big fight because I think most Democratic senators are certainly enough to make a filibuster impossible. We'll say, obviously, if we'd won, this is not the person we would have picked. We didn't. They won, and they, you know, pretty decisively. And they've got the Senate. This guy's a good guy, and he's the sort of conservative. If you're going to have any conservatives on the Supreme Court, he's the kind you want.
But it's certainly true, David. You know, you can say that this isn't what drove you. There are a lot of conservatives, some actually who supported Harriet Myers, who said that they are driven by policy outcomes. They wanted a justice. You know, part of the conservative base of the Republican Party wants certain judges on the court to get certain policy outcomes. That's undeniable. We saw that from the social conservatives.
Right. But we had that debate, and the side that won was the side that said, we want somebody that makes the whole country proud.
Well, I'm sorry. Having a justice on who might, you know, undo the right to privacy and abortion would not make the whole country proud. And I mean, that's a fundamental issue. And if that and Bush said he wanted people in the mode of Scalia and Thomas, which was sending a signal. These are people who follow certain policy outcomes. No one thinks, you know, he didn't want someone in the mode of Justice Thomas because he's considered one of the biggest and brightest legal scholars in the world. He wanted him because he was sending a message because of the conservative outcomes of his policy decisions.
We're not going to agree on this, but right. David Frum, let me ask you a question. Many conservative groups that had been raising money around the issue of the Supreme Court nomination, some of them for years, kept their powder dry during the Myers nomination and declined to put out the kind of advertising and other kinds of efforts that we saw, certainly for Judge Roberts. Do you expect that those groups will come around now?
Oh, I think you'll see enormous conservative support, but I don't think I may be wrong about this, and I may be naive and idealistic. I don't think you're going to see a tremendous battle over Samuel Alito. I think there will certainly be money spent on TV ads by supporters and opponents, but as this nomination comes before the Senate, as Americans get to view him, even people, certainly many of the senators, I think even people in the country, I mean, many of them almost as passionate as David Corn, will say, gosh, I mean, there's going to be conservative judges on the court, and if there are going to be some, this is the kind there ought to be. Mm-hmm. I mean, it can't be that the liberals get all the seats.
No, I think that was actually the attitude towards John Roberts. And John Roberts was replacing Rehnquist, and now you have someone who was very conservative replacing someone who wasn't. And so I think a review of his decisions and his performance at the confirmation hearing may be what tilts it one way or the other for Democratic senators.
Yeah, I think here I will just venture a prediction. You will not see a filibuster, and I think he will win the votes of at least a dozen and maybe as many as two dozen of the Democrats.
I mean, I think that's possible. I don't do predictions.
Okay, and we'll leave it there, but we suspect we may be back with both of you before too long. David Frum, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
David Frum writes a blog for the National Review Online. He's a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and he joined us from the BBC studios here in Washington, D.C. David Corn was kind enough to join us here in Studio 3A. He's Washington editor of The Nation magazine. David, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you, Neil.
We're talking about today's nomination by President Bush of Samuel Alito, a judge on the Third Circuit Court of Appeals in Philadelphia, to replace Sandra Day O'Connor, who has submitted her resignation as Supreme Court Justice. The President hopes to get the Senate Judiciary Committee to hold hearings by the end of this year. The Senate Judiciary Committee thus far is talking about maybe in January. You're listening to special coverage from NPR News.
On AM 580 WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. It is 8 minutes before 2 o'clock. We break away here now to bring you up to date on what happened today on the Chicago Board of Trade. Standing by with the numbers, Todd Gleason. Todd.
Thank you very much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade on this afternoon, let's take a look at what happened at the Chicago Board of Trade and the numbers as they finished up for the day. And just a reminder that during the closing market report this afternoon, we'll talk with Kurt Kimmel of Grainfield Marketing out of Normal, Illinois. Kurt, of course, will take a complete look at what happened at the Chicago Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange. Those numbers from the board finished up like this. The December wheat today had a high of 319.5, a low of 316. A settlement price for the day at $3.17. They were down 3/4 for the day. The March futures, a 332.5 high, low of 331. Settlement price 332.75. They were off 1/4. And the May wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade, 342.5 the high, the low at 339.75. Settlement price at 341, down 1/4. July futures, 349.5 the high, the low at 47. Settlement price at $3.48.75, unchanged. And September futures in the wheat pit, 357 the high, the low at 355. Settlement price at 356.5, and they finished the day unchanged. December corn futures, $1.97 the high, the low at $1.96. Settlement price at 196.25. They were off 3/4 today. March futures 210.5 the high, the low at 210 even. Settlement price at 210.25, down 1/4. And May futures in the corn pit 219.25 the high, the low at 218.25. Settlement price at 218.75, down 0.5. July futures 226.75 the high, the low at 25.5, and a settlement price at $2.25.75 for the July corn. They were off 1 cent on the day. September futures, a 233 settlement price, down 1, a 234 high, the low at 233 as well for the September corn. And next year's Dease futures, the red December, 243.75, the high, the low at 243, settlement price at 243.25. They were off 3/4 today. From the oat pit, the nearby December contract, a 162.75 high, low at $1.58.5, a settlement price there at $1.58.75. They were down 4 cents today. The March futures off 3 at 170.75 in the oat pit. From the soy complex now, nearby November, soybeans traded 1/4 lower, 566 the high, the low at 562.5. Settlement price at 564.75, down 1/4. January futures, 577.25 the high, the low at 573. Settlement price at 576. They were off 1.5 cents for the day. March contract at 585.25 high, low at 582. Settled 584.25, down 1.75 in the May futures, a 592 high, low at 589. Settled at 589.5. They were off 3 in the July soybeans. 597 the high, the low at $5.94.5. Settled 595.5 a bushel, down 3 cents. August contract down 2.5 cents today. A settlement price at 595.5, the high at 97.5, the low down at that $5.95 settlement price for the August soybeans. And November futures had a 603 high, the low at $6 even.
settled a half above that at $6.50. They were off 4 cents for next year's November contract in the bean pit. December bean meal, $170.20, the high, the low at $168 even, settled $169.70. They were up 90 for the day. January's were up 80 cents at $171.50 with a high of $171.70 and a low at $170 even. December bean oil, $23.20, the high, low at $22.85. Settlement price there at $22.86, and they were off 47. And the January futures, a $23.42 high, low at $23.11. Settlement price at $23.13. They were off 41 for the day. Now here's Celeste with the numbers for the Mercantile Exchange.
Okay, let's take a look at what happened today on the Merc. November feeder cattle, the high $116.35, the low $115.60, the settlement $115.85, that up 50. January $114.75, the high $113.50, the low $113.87 and a half, the settlement, that up 35. March $111.45, the high $110.30, the low, the settlement $110.60, that unchanged. October live cattle $89.90, the high $88.even, the low $88.50, the settlement, that down 50. December $92.45, the high $90.85, the low $90.92 and a half, the settlement, that down 37 and a half. December lean hogs, today's high $62.20, the low $60.95, the settlement $61.67 and a half, that up 72 and a half. February $66.even, the high $64.75, the low $65.90, the settlement, that up 105. April lean hogs, the contract high today $65.80, the low $65.10, the settlement $65.67 and a half, that up 75. And May lean hogs, $67.50, the high $66.35, the low $67.12 and a half, the settlement, that up 112 and a half. February bellies, $90.60, the high $88.55, the low $89.02 and a half, the settlement, that down 57 and a half. The Dow is up 56 points at 10,458. The NASDAQ up 30 points at 2120. The S&P 500 10 higher at 1208.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from First Midwest Bank, serving the banking needs of Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Kathy Ferguson and Morris at 815-941-3758. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
You're tuned to The Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. We're online at WILL.UIU. Let me take that back. WILL.UIUC.EDU. Coming up this afternoon, news from National Public Radio that at 1 minute past 2 o'clock, then it's the closing market report with Todd Gleason. Coming up this afternoon at 3 o'clock, we'll have the first half of the program, The World, and then we will broadcast the Capital Steps Politics Takes a Holiday Halloween special. That will air this afternoon at 3:30. It will be repeated at 6:30 this evening. And